Blog Talk Radio.
The President of the United States is arguably the most important position in the world. As the leader of the free world, the safety of the President is an important job for the dedicated servicemen and women willing to take a bullet for POTUS and to keep them and their families safe for life. But not every day is dodging bullets from Jodie Foster fanboys. It's a little more pedestrian than that. Today we're exploring what life is like as a member of the Secret Service. But first, before we can grant you security clearance to watch, go ahead and check the subscribe button and let us know what government entity you would like to hear more about. Now, the big cat is on the move. The big cat is on the move. Presidents are, at the end of the day, human beings just like you and me, only with nuclear codes. They enjoy kicking back and relaxing as much as the next average Joe. In order to keep the president safe at all times, including leisurely times, they sometimes have to take up the same hobbies and interests as their boss. But sometimes that works out just fine. Take Ronald Reagan, for example, a big fan of horses. Yes, before there was trickle-down economics, there was Trickle the Horse. Reagan's Secret Service agent on duty, John Barletta, loved a good jaunt on a horse, too, and the two would often ride around Reagan's private ranch. Not exactly the unsafest place in the country for a president to be, but Barletta still had a job to do in case there was a sudden gust of wind or a temperamental horse. In general, Reagan was known to be pretty kind to his Secret Service agents and also had one of the most favorable hobbies that a member of the Secret Service would be forced to participate in. Bill Clinton turned himself into an avid runner during his tenure as president, which was a real pain in the butt for Secret Service members to keep up with. Clinton was slow, sure, but also stubbornly refused to run on any self-contained indoor track, military base, or treadmill. He wanted to run around in public with the people, where all the crime could be, and sweeping the area was complicated, cumbersome, and expensive. The Secret Service also had the extra fun duty of completing these runs while being weighed down with heavy guns, bulky radios, and dress shoes. Exercising for a president was surprisingly foreign up until the 90s, but Clinton used these as less of a heart-healthy, stress-reducing me time and more of a where-can-I-find-the-nearest McDonald's time. With agents around the president 24/7, they sometimes have to endure more than just potentially dangerous situations. They also have the distinction of getting involved in painfully awkward ones as well. President Lyndon Johnson, for example, sounded like a real peach. He lashed out at agents when they didn't do what he wanted, which included following traffic laws. Johnson allegedly ordered an agent to break the law and jump the curb when running late to an event. When the agent refused, because that's hardly a safe way to drive, Johnson threw a fit. Johnson attempted to fire that safe driver the next day, but his job was saved after Johnson's secretary intervened, and he got off light. Johnson was a randy man who enjoyed the company of women who were not Ladybird, and his agents had a real fun time trying to navigate around his affairs with women. LBJ even chose to have one of his trysts with his secretaries in the Oval Office, which his wife had the misfortune to walk in on. After screaming at the agents for failing to warn him that his wife was on the way, an alarm system was installed to prevent it from happening again, as opposed to LBJ just not having an extramarital affair in his office. Presidents, they're just like us. They get a little moody sometimes. Former agent and author of Within Arm's Length, a Secret Service agent's definitive inside account of protecting the president, Dan Emmett, worked for both Bush's, W&H, as well as Clinton. When asked who his favorite president was to protect, Dan took the fifth and refused to answer. Each man had personal highs and lows with good days and bad days. Not that hard to imagine that Obama's mood might be different on the same day that he's been passing out candy to a very tiny child dressed as the Pope versus the day they killed bin Laden. Not all agents speak with the discretion of Emmett, however. Agents who protected Richard Nixon described him as a stone-cold weirdo, with many calling him the strangest president, though what is that sample size exactly? Depressed and paranoid, Nixon, codenamed Searchlight, supposedly dipped into some extremely odd behavior, including eating dog biscuits and less odd behavior such as getting hammered on martinis during the day. Jimmy Carter came into office in 1977 with four children and zero peanut farms. His youngest daughter was only 9 years old when Carter was sworn into office, so Secret Service agents had to work double duty to serve the President of the United States and to be babysitters. Good, affordable childcare can be so hard to find. Amy Carter required a Secret Service escort for something as innocuous as attending a sleepover, often putting in overtime to do so. When Amy wanted to go to a friend's house instead of being brought home after school, as they were instructed to do, she'd pull the low-key, "Do you know who my father is?" and would phone Daddy for permission, who often told her guards to take her wherever she wants to go, which is questionable parenting at best, but Jimmy had bigger things on his plate. Amy, a real sweetheart, was also known to purposefully leave crumbs like Hansel and Gretel, only less to remember where she was, and more because she was a brat who thought it funny for her Secret Service detail to clean up after her. His son, however, also a sweetheart, who went by Chip, was slightly more nefarious. He was recently separated, liked to party, and loved to bring home randoms to the White House, which made him a gas to protect. Presidents aren't the only ones under constant threat of being assassinated. Vice presidents require 24-hour protection, too. Spiro Agnew, the VP to President Nixon until 1973, before it got too dicey, was prone to throw parties for his service detail and was referred to as a cop buff. In return, his Secret Service agents would throw parties for this cop buff, who would later become paranoid that his new friends, paid service detail, were talking crap about him behind his back, which, to be fair, they probably totally were. Although generally believed to have a cordial relationship with this service detail, Agnew didn't make himself less of an easy target by also needing extramarital affairs to be covered by his agents, asking for hotel rooms that could only be booked if his lover's room could be booked beside him. And they say romance is dead. The Secret Service was inconsistent when it came to the care of the president's canine friends, and rarely said thank you or please when asking agents to do more than their sworn duty demanded. For example, it probably was not a life or death scenario for President Lyndon Johnson, who's coming across just swimmingly here in general, when he asked his agents to take his dog, Yuki, out on a particularly rainy day. "Secret Service, take care of Yuki," he demanded into the air as he threw his dog outside of his Texas ranch. Though this was not a strange demand from LBJ, his detail did resent that there was nary a please or thank you thrown in the way for taking care of a muddy dog. Yuki was returned to the ranch, but not before getting the sheets all muddy, which resulted in a second non-life or death demand to clean up the damn dog. All of this according to Dennis McCarthy, who detailed his time on duty serving LBJ, whom he described as treating the guys as hired hands. When Hubert Humphrey asked a member of his service detail, Chuck Vance, Vance clapped back and told Humphrey that while he wasn't allowed to walk his dog, he would be more obliged to walk you, sir. Meow. This kitty likes to scratch. Not all stories of protecting and serving end with being riddled with bullets. Some end with love. Our old friend Chuck Vance protected both Vice Presidents Humphrey and Agnew before being reassigned to California to protect Gerald Ford after Ford left office. It was here where Vance caught the eye of Ford's daughter, Susan, and the two struck up a relationship that at first was secret and sexy, and later would become tumultuous and not sexy. When Betty Ford found out about the relationship, Mama was pissed and had Vance relocated. It was less of the on dad's payroll thing about Vance and more the he is divorced with two kids that left Betty unsettled. Susan, who we presume was rebelling against her mother, married Vance anyways in 1979, where Vance would soon leave the agency to go into private security. The couple would divorce in 1988, meaning Mom, as per usual, was right. Oh, Mom. A great security detail is one you should never see coming. Like a referee in an NBA game, if they're doing their job correctly, you won't even notice they're there. Because of this, agents often blended into the background and became a witness to some of the more vulnerable moments in a president's day-to-day life. They're silent observers. Dennis McCarthy recalled President Nixon weeping when the Watergate scandal that would bring down his presidency began. Agents were also witnesses to affairs, drug use, and drinking. Slightly disconcerting things to hear about men with the nuclear codes, but because agents' presence were so common, presidents didn't give it a second thought. How comforting. Mm-hmm. Much like anything worth protecting, guarding the president wasn't always easy, and some didn't help in making their service detail's job any easier by participating in reckless behavior. Famous playboy JFK also kept it interesting for a security detail. Kennedy liked the company of women who were not his wife. According to the agent Ronald Kessler in the book, In the President's Secret Service, Behind the Scenes with the Agents in the Line of Fire and the Presidents They Protect, geez, can anybody write a book with a nice, short title? Kennedy was entertaining two women when it was discovered Jackie O was coming home early. Kennedy hopped out of the pool and gave his unfinished drink to a nearby agent, saying, Enjoy it, it's quite good. Unfortunately, we all know what happened on November 22, 1963. Choosing to parade in Dallas in an open-top convertible over Secret Service objections, Kennedy became the only president assassinated on the Secret Service's watch. Technically, the legislation creating the agency was on Lincoln's desk the day he was assassinated. The one thing most presidents have in common is they love golf. According to Agent Clint Hill, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's main hobby was hitting the links. He'd store a pair of cleats in the Oval Office so he could throw those bad boys on and putt in the halls of the White House during all the downtime presidents famously have. After he would putt, it was the job of his valet, Sergeant John Mone, to run and fetch it. Yes, like a dog. But Mone actually enjoyed the task, or so he said. If on a public course, Eisenhower would be accompanied by a service detail with a Thompson submachine gun, which is not the best way to hit a golf ball, but in a pinch can really lay the wood. On the other hand, agents felt bad for Nixon because, while Nixon enjoyed golf, he was not particularly good. One agent said, when you saw him play golf, you were embarrassed for him. I mean, it was awful. Eventually, Nixon, being very chill, gave up on the game of golf and decried it as a game for lazy bastards. Weird, because Donald Trump seems to love it so much. But that's for weird history in 2052. So what do you think? Would you want to serve in the Secret Service? Let us know in the comments below, and while you're at it, check out some of these other fine videos from our weird history.
Say what?
Protecting the president. These are the stories you never knew. A rioting mob surrounds President George Bush Sr. in Panama. Al-Qaeda targets President Clinton in Pakistan. And a lone wolf takes aim at President George W. Bush in the former Soviet Union.
Hand grenade was tossed at the President of the United States.
Now, for the first time, special agents relive these high-threat events.
Yeah, my heart was racing.
Dealing with the most important man, most powerful person in the world, absolutely no margin for error.
Each Secret Service agent is ready to make the ultimate sacrifice.
I'd rather be dead than labeled a coward.
Go to your country to try to stay alive.
It was Friday. It was a beautiful sunny day. I was a shift later, and our shift was to fly with President Clinton on Air Force One to Cincinnati for a fundraiser. Routine trip.
But then the Secret Service gets word. The King of Morocco has died, and President Clinton must attend the funeral.
That's what's interesting about the Secret Service. I mean, here you are, you think you're going to Cincinnati. You end up flying 3,000 miles to another country for a funeral. And it's all at the last minute. Don't even blink. Where do you want me to go? Let's do it.
Special Agent Robert Rodriguez was about to confront the most dangerous and difficult assignment of his career.
Probably the most high-risk thing that I had experienced in the Secret Service.
In 22 and a half years of serving as a special agent in the United States Secret Service,
there are moments that we feel vulnerable. Probably the greatest moment was here working with President Clinton for King Hassan's funeral.
This was no ordinary memorial service.
60 heads of state showed up for this funeral. Not only President Clinton, former President Bush, Yasser Arafat, Jacques Chirac, kings, queens, presidents, ambassadors, ministers. Extremely problematic. Absolutely.
Dozens of world leaders walking a 3.2 kilometer procession amidst a massive crowd. Thousands overwhelmed security. Any of them could be armed with weapons or explosives. For Agent Rodriguez, ensuring the safety of President Clinton is an almost impossible mission.
King Hassan was highly revered and highly regarded by his people and people outside the country of Morocco.
كانوا الناس مخلوع عين وكانوا الناس كتبكي هذاك النهار ما كيتنساش المغرب كاع كله هو نيا
صبنا بزاف زعما كون بحال الوالد بزاف صبنا
وشكي هو البكاء راه يعني الناس كتنعس من الارض يعني فوق بزاف.
When they opened up the doors of the palace, it basically opens up to a sea of humanity.
On the ground with Agent Rodriguez, Special Agent Rich Staropoli.
At the time I was with the counter-assault team.
The counter-assault team is the Secret Service's unseen muscle for situations that warrant rapid assault and lethal force.
The function of the counter-assault team is to identify, locate, and neutralize any threat.
Today, threats are everywhere. When heads of state show up, so do fanatics, terrorists, and assassins.
We knew we were going to find ourselves right in the middle of it. The only thing that spins people up more than a religious conversation is the death of their leader. And when their leader happens to be a religious icon, that's the makings for something really bad to happen.
Rodriguez and his Secret Service agents assess the risks and request that the president only walk for part of the funeral procession. But the president has other plans.
President Clinton wanted to show his respect and reverence to the king, and so we took that 2-mile walk.
They were really good about trying to be flexible because they knew I liked to be with people. They knew I liked to stop the motorcade in any foreign country and just get out and walk the streets.
This may look like a typical boulevard on an ordinary day, but on July 25th, 1999, imagine over 2 million people hanging in balconies, open windows, rooftops, sitting in trees, emotional, screaming, crying. It was a 2-mile procession from the palace to the mausoleum.
A 3.2 kilometer walk that challenges all known Secret Service tactics and procedures. The thousands in this uncontained mob are unscreened and present a potential threat. Guns, dirty bombs, suicide vests could be hidden anywhere.
It only takes one person. It creates great risk for us.
But the mission is a go, with no time to secure the route.
Knowing that we're not going to have the counter-assault team in place where we need them, the emergency motorcade where we'd like to have it, the counter-sniper team effectively doing their advance and counting how many windows exposed to the president, how many of those windows are open. We had none of that.
And as the funeral procession made its way through the streets of Morocco, people were coming out of the woodwork. There were people all over us. 2 million people doing anything they could to get close enough to that coffin.
Yeah. obvious danger is never far from their minds.
If the people are that emotional and there's millions and they all rush to the casket, potentially you can be trampled.
I came more and more to value what they did, the risks they took, and the risks they avoided. So if they weren't around, it would be harder to do the job, as well as riskier to do the job.
The job of the agents protecting President Clinton is getting riskier by the minute.
There was nothing holding these people back. They were free to roam and fill the streets at their will, and that's exactly what they did. And in the middle of it happened to have been the President of the United States and one of the former presidents of the United States, neither of whom were very well liked in that region.
Ship leader Agent Rodriguez takes up various positions to scope out potential attackers.
At one point, I moved out in front so that I could watch the rear coverage of the ship and also have a better vantage point of the whole situation.
While Agent Staropoli fights to stay on task.
The counter-assault team travels in a vehicle within the motorcade. So now you have a big decision to make here. Do you stay in the truck and basically run these people over to get to where you need to go, or leave the truck, abandon your vehicle, and walk? And that was the decision that we made. We left a driver with the vehicle, split the team, and then continued to parallel the president on foot.
At one point, they started to come over the barricades. That was very concerning.
You can't be afraid to lay hands on people. And at some points, that's exactly what you're doing in a crowd like that. You need to physically move people out of your way.
I'm thinking, where do we put the president? And the only place that I saw that had a potential opening and maybe some coverage was underneath the casket. This is when you start to get desperate. Are you going to put the President of the United States underneath a casket?
The evidence is overwhelming. It's time to stop this walk.
This is no joke, and certainly when you're surrounded by 2 million people, or who are whipped up into a religious frenzy. It just got worse and worse.
Rabat, Morocco. U.S. Secret Service agents Staropoli and Rodriguez face one of their most dangerous security missions. Protect President Clinton from an out-of-control crowd.
Morocco was just, basically you were walking through the middle of a prison riot where you didn't know what was going to happen.
For President Clinton and the agents sworn to protect him on this 3.2-kilometer walk, potential danger is all around. Sniper on the rooftop. Terrorist with a bomb.
You're dealing with tremendous unknown. You've got to focus on what you're doing, who's around you, and make an immediate decision. Is this guy a threat or not?
But sometimes, you just have to make a dangerous situation work.
It's not the Secret Service's job to tell the president he can't go somewhere. It's our job to adapt and get him in and out of there safely.
Adaptability is key with 2 million potentially unscreened people closing in on the president. And the mausoleum still 800 meters away. Agents Staropoli and Rodriguez are fighting heat and exhaustion.
We're dressed all in black to include black boots and a load-bearing vest. So total weight of each counter-assault team operator is approximately 50 pounds of gear. Very difficult to deal with something like that.
These agents are under tremendous strain. But one thought remains constant.
The one thing about the mission, I've never met an agent that ever second-guessed whether he would take a bullet for the president. I'd rather be dead than labeled a coward.
Agent Agent Rodriguez and his officers are ready to make the ultimate sacrifice. When they reach their final destination.
After a 2-mile walk in about 100 degree temperatures, we finally made it to the mausoleum where you can see behind me King Hassan is laid to rest. And I recall walking up those stairs and how bright the marble was with the sun illuminating on it.
It's a definite sigh of relief because this was an enclosed, protected area. We were inside.
We knew this was the end, and frankly was pretty pleased that that was the end of that part of the day.
We fully expected something bad to happen, whether it was going to be somebody fires a shot, whether it's at one of our protectees or just in general. Fortunately, it just never came to fruition.
President George Bush Sr. touches down in unstable territory.
In June 1992, the president was on a South American tour, and it was after the Panamanian revolt and overthrow of Noriega. Hostile takeover, and the decision was made that President Bush would stop in there to meet the new president.
Special Agent Funk was in Panama with the counter-assault team, or CAT. Highly equipped and battle ready.
The CAT team are there to provide enhanced armament, enhanced weapons that the actual detail staff doesn't have.
Advanced Intel warns of grave risks.
We had been receiving intelligence that this was still a very tense area in Panama, especially Panama City, and there was still a high level of anti-American sentiment. Military checkpoints were still throughout the city.
A crowd of over 15,000 shows up to see President Bush.
This is a very festive atmosphere. Balloons, children in white dresses, singing songs. People were happy.
But 180 meters away, a group grows agitated.
The situation is deteriorating. The protest was so widespread, it encompassed many streets surrounding this plaza.
Anti-American demonstrators clash with police.
Agents behind them starting to have a heightened level of alertness. They realize, based on what they're seeing, what they're hearing, and the radio traffic, that there is a demonstration that is getting out of hand.
Special Agent Robert Rodriguez was also there.
I was on the counter-assault team. We could hear what was happening over the radio, that there was some kind of problem because of an unruly crowd that seemed to be gathering and getting too close to where the protectee was.
When we were receiving these reports over the radio, we were in our counter-assault vehicle, our black Suburban. It was strategic, this quick access to the stage.
Asians are on edge. The hostile crowd is storming the park.
Thousands of people. This thing is starting to get out of control. The police are on high alert. They're intense. Police cannot contain. The crowd is advancing, and they're starting to breach the gate. Tear gas was deployed.
We could hear gunshots. We could hear chants. We knew there was a situation unfolding. There were a lot of people running around with guns. You have bad guys with bandanas, like outlaws in the West with weapons. So it was a very confusing situation.
You're trying to mitigate risk. There's an unruly crowd and you hear gunfire. That's pretty much all you need to know. The well-being of the president is more important than the pomp and circumstance.
As a bad scene turns worse, Agent Funk braces for bloodshed.
We had reports that people were shot. This is a critical situation, and we in the Secret Service need to take action.
High stakes means big guns.
We deployed, and we came into that scene on the stage. Basically, a riot was unfolding, and it was just a matter of time before that riot overwhelmed where we were.
As the Panamanian police launched tear gas, the counter-assault team moves into action.
That was the first time a CAT team had a full formal deployment. The president is starting to feel the effects of the tear gas. In true President Bush fashion, he was reluctant to leave the stage.
The president wants to deliver the speech, but the Secret Service has another idea.
Tear gas, unruly mob, and gunshots. It's not a hard decision. Time to leave. And you have a split second to make the decision that you're going to cover and evacuate.
Cover and evacuate. The Secret Service's signature protective tactic.
The doctrines of the Secret Service. 360-degree coverage above, below, and around. And evacuate the president and get him out of there safely.
Agent Funk watches the tape.
This is the first time I'm seeing this footage. It's bringing back a lot of the pandemonium, the panic, and the confusion that was going on.
Agents act as trained. They cover President Bush, while Agent Funk and the CAT team create a shield between the president and danger.
We're charging our weapons. That's me in the front. That's me. It's a kneeling crouch position, which, should we have to go into a shooting situation, provides a very stable shooting platform.
Next step, evacuate. It's a harrowing escape. President Bush is quickly whisked into the safety of the armored limo.
The decision was made to remove the president to the secure environment of the limousine. The level of violence was there. The level of mayhem was present.
President Clinton is headed into a war zone. His objective, urge the government of Pakistan to restore democracy after a military coup.
Once we decided to go after bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda, and the others, from the time I did that, I knew that whenever I was in another country where a terrorist might penetrate, I was in greater danger.
Danger couldn't be greater right now. Pakistan is Al-Qaeda territory, and Bill Clinton is a prime target.
This trip to Pakistan definitely put the resourcefulness of the Secret Service to the test. Things were breaking bad again in the region. Osama bin Laden was talking about death to America.
The most disturbing news comes from the CIA.
Intelligence agencies had information about bin Laden's intentions to attempt an assassination on President Clinton. It wasn't a good situation.
Special Agent Rich Staropoli was on the ground in Pakistan.
I was with the counter-assault team, where I was actually privy to a conversation where we did openly discuss amongst ourselves that our recommendation is don't go on this trip. To which I believe the reply was, well, it's your job to make sure nothing happens. So what do you say to that? against our better judgment, we went into Pakistan. The Al-Qaeda community, the Taliban, they certainly didn't want to see the stars and bars flown in on Air Force One. Definitely not a place we want to go into. This is a huge undertaking, comparable to probably what went into the D-Day invasion. That's what went into this. We packed the entire world with us.
En route to Pakistan, the Secret Service gets word. More troubling intelligence.
Quickly, things go from bad to worse. A large cache of automatic weapons has been found in a house not too far from the airport runway that Air Force One was going to use. We're bringing everything with us into, you know, the heart of Al-Qaeda headquarters. Our objective was to get in and out of there as quickly as possible. Let him accomplish what he needed to, and then get back to a safe haven.
In the air, Air Force One. On the ground, terrorists with easy access to weapons of war.
Shoulder-fired missiles, automatic weapons, AK-47s, which are so readily available in that region. Finding 50 of these is not a big deal. They're all over the place.
And now, intel that an attack on Air Force One may be imminent. A raid on a house near the airport flushes out insurgents armed with heavy artillery.
There was a real concern that as Air Force One was making its approach, that someone with a shoulder-launched weapon, Stinger missile, could easily hit that plane and bring it down.
President Clinton is flying into Pakistan, but Air Force One is in the crosshairs. Special Agent Rich Star Pauly knows an enemy lying in wait requires secret strategies and maneuvers.
From the very moment we start for this trip, all sorts of ruse tactics were employed.
The stunts and psychops begin now.
So Air Force One is flown into Pakistan.
Agent Star Pauly knows the airport runway is vulnerable to attack.
Perfect vantage point to accomplish the objective of shooting down an aircraft from the end of that runway with a Stinger missile.
Air Force One approaches. At any moment, disaster could strike.
Certainly a good place for the unfriendlies to stage a hit. Not something we wanted to walk into. Here comes Air Force One on its final approach. Coming in low, it's coming in slow, just like any other 747 would.
Then, those expecting to see the president are surprised by what happens next.
Plane lands, taxis, makes its turn, and parks. The staircase is wheeled up to Air Force One. Door is open, and out steps the president. Only it wasn't the president. It was actually a Secret Service agent. While that was going on and all the eyes of the world's attention was drawn to Air Force One, a second plane came in, much smaller, unmarked, flying in a unique flight pattern, approached from the opposite direction and landed. And just prior to it stopping, the motorcade pulls up. The armored limousine parks in between the real Air Force One. And out steps President Clinton. So the ruse worked. The element of surprise was on our side for that time.
President Clinton steps safely onto the tarmac. But the Secret Service remain on high alert. Intelligence warns that the Pakistani secret police might be infiltrated.
The briefings that we attended indicated that the Pakistani secret police was permeated with Al-Qaeda sympathizers. Now you're driving down the middle of the road with the ISI, who was in the motorcade, that some of whom we were working with were Al-Qaeda sympathizers. Incredibly tense situation, just prone to something happening.
And so the schemes and subterfuge continue.
Then it begins a shell game. You have six armored vehicles in the motorcade.
Riding in the presidential limo at the center of this paramilitary convoy is President Clinton. or not.
As the motorcade would make its way from the airport, we began to move the limousine bearing the President of the United States back a few cars and then moved an empty one up ahead. All the vehicles were flying flags, and all the vehicles had presidential seals on them, which is unusual. It'd be real difficult for anyone to figure out exactly which car he was in. You have six armored vehicles in the motorcade, now you have a 1 in 6 chance of being right and hitting the car bearing the president. So you have to continually be thinking, okay, if A happens, what am I going to do? If B happens, where are we going? There's a lot of communication that's going on while that motorcade is in motion. This is definitely a thinking man game, and it certainly was that day.
We share your disappointment that previous Democratic governments in Pakistan did not do better for their citizens.
Clinton's speech lasts a mere 15 minutes.
Clinton delivered his speech, which was pretty well received. Secret Service can't afford to relax. You still have to get out of there. And that's normally where people let their guard down.
The same threats loom on the way back.
We still don't know where Osama bin Laden is. We don't know how many other Al-Qaeda operatives are running around.
I knew the Secret Service was there, and I knew they would do the best job anyone could do.
Agents rise to the occasion. President Clinton is bundled into the safety of his armored limo.
He got back in the motorcade and flew out of there. Trip is over. There's a big sense of relief. You can see it in the president. You can see it in the staff. We don't think it's a job well done until we land back at the White House.
President George W. Bush is flying into the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. He's scheduled to address a massive crowd in Tbilisi's Freedom Square.
The Georgian people love the United States. They felt grateful that the United States helped accelerate the collapse of the Soviet Union and therefore their freedom. So they wanted to show their appreciation to President Bush.
Special Agent Tom Fuentes headed up international operations for the FBI.
The Secret Service is responsible for the protection of the president, but if the U.S. president actually gets attacked, the FBI is responsible to conduct the investigation.
Agent Fuentes is at the very spot where President Bush had a chilling brush with death.
On May 10th, 2005, an event took place here that could have altered world history and especially American history.
Special Agent Brian Parman was the FBI agent on the ground in Tbilisi.
My job was to work in coordination with the Georgian Ministry of Internal Affairs to investigate crimes.
Today, Agent Parman is about to tackle the biggest crime of his career.
On the day of the speech at Freedom Square, the lines really started forming about 7 a.m. And obviously the Secret Service had set up magnetometers to screen the crowd in.
Magnetometers, or metal detectors. The Secret Service's first line of defense at any presidential event. And this one is growing in size by the minute.
By 10 a.m., it was evident that the crowds were much greater than what had been estimated. I mean, quite frankly, his popularity was absolutely amazing. They had named the highway leading out to the main airport after him. So the crowds swelled and continued to grow and continued to grow. And what was estimated to be 10,000 quickly grew to 25 to 50,000.
Some estimate as high as 100,000 people. They were jamming those security checkpoints.
And they were pushing against the magnetometer so much so that people were getting crushed. People were getting hurt.
So the Georgian authorities just shut off the machines and let everybody into the square completely unscreened.
For the Secret Service, this is a security nightmare.
Now the Secret Service, knowing that George Bush would be speaking at 1:30 in the afternoon, advised him of how dangerous this was going to be to come out here in this square in front of tens of thousands of people who had not been screened and to give a speech.
But the president is determined.
He can't walk away from this. He has to address the people of Georgia. In spite of the danger, he is not going to leave this stage area. He's going to speak, and he does.
This crowd is officially a threat. With the metal detectors out of play, any of these people could be carrying a dangerous weapon.
They had an unscreened crowd. The best that you can do is try and move the crowd back to get some standoff and rely on the bulletproof glass in the podium.
But nearby, a man with murder on his mind.
I'm not a good person. I'm not a good person. I'm not a good person. Я спокойно вовсе не был, но внешне так, может быть, выглядел. Я не знаю, Ра, ты вот такой вот приходит, и ты хлопаешь ему. Это мне очень больно было, понимаете, как-то вот непонятно это было мне.
Vladimir Aratunian is pushing his way closer to the stage. In his hand, he clutches an explosive packed with TNT.
Я просто долго в руках держал его, понимаете? Чтобы не видно было, потому я ее вот так вот, сюда платок завернул, вот так вот держал. Просто, чтобы наподобие, как камень, вот так бросил, вот так.
President Bush is addressing an excited crowd in Tbilisi, Georgia. He doesn't know a man has marked him for death.
And the world. An individual located in the crowd wearing a dark leather jacket, wrapped a red scarf around a hand grenade, pulled the firing pin and threw the grenade toward the president.
Special Agent Parman was on the ground in Tbilisi.
A live hand grenade had been thrown in the crowd and landed approximately 50 feet from where the president was speaking.
Disaster was averted when the handkerchief, wrapped tightly around the grenade, slowed the firing pin.
The firing pin did not hit hard enough to actually set off the explosion. The fact that it didn't go off was just a miracle.
It landed short over in this area here, bouncing off a little girl's head. At that time, a police officer here in the square observed that something had hit this little girl, and not knowing if it was a rock or some other debris, went over to see.
First responder, Officer David Nanabaitse, pounced on the bomb.
Say what?
All right, so the Secret Service and what they do, it's a truly amazing when you put it into this perspective, that they do a lot to protect the President of the United States. What you're listening to is how they protect the president. And, you know, this is kind of like a step-by-step of how they protect the president. To me, they put a lot on the line when they do this, when they protect, you know, put their life on the line. And it's awesome to hear the immense work that they do and the length that they go to protecting the president. So there's a lot that they do, a lot of planning, a lot of work to do, to be done. I mean, this all shows you how hard it is and the work that they do to protect our presidents, our vice presidents, and so forth. And so you're listening to the documentary based on that. Me personally, I will tell you that my encounter, I think, was with Bill Clinton. I went there to visit Bill Clinton at a rally in Cincinnati. And I remember when I was going through the crowd, you know, I wanted to get up and of course, you know, a lot of people wanted to shake his hand and you know, they wanted to welcome him to Cincinnati. And the Secret Service, I remember I had an ink pen and I went to give them my ink pen to sign, you know, my autograph, you know, have Bill Clinton sign it. And of course they said, no, we'll use our ink pen for him to sign it. And it was kind of crazy. I understand why they do it now after, you know, what they have to do, the measures they have to go through. And I remember in Cincinnati that everybody, you know, we're big for our Skyline cheese conies and three ways and chili. It's a chili spaghetti. And so these people were trying to give Bill Clinton all these cheese conies. And I mean, that's the first thing they were trying to do, is just give him cheese conies as a welcome to Cincinnati. And the Secret Service wasn't going to have it. They weren't going to allow anybody to give Bill Clinton anything. That was my first rally I ever went to, that I actually witnessed as a teenager. And so, you know, fast forward, I think the next one I went to was Bill Clinton, or it was actually, no, Barack Obama. And he drew such a large crowd that I remember that we had to go to an area, and they were shuttle busing everybody over to a park where Obama was going to hold his rally speech. And so we get to the park. I mean, there's thousands upon thousands. I mean, it's crazy. And they kind of hurdle everybody, and they take everybody and they put them in like cattle into into one area. And then you had to go from one big, you know, immense crowd down to one single line, filed line going through a checkpoint. And I remember going through metal detectors. I remember, you know, having to take everything out of my pockets and prove whatever I had in my pockets was, you know, legitimate. For example, I had some blood pressure medicine in my pocket, and they wanted to make sure that it was not gunpowder or anything that was an explosive. And of course, they checked that medication, and before they would return it back to me at the end of the line that I was going through. But you were not allowed to have any buttons on that had Obama on it. No campaign buttons, no flags, no nothing you would carry in with your hands. And once you got inside, they would provide you with certain things like, you know, banners to hold up and so forth. And so they would provide that kind of stuff for you, but they would not allow you to bring your own stuff in through the checkpoint. So it's pretty cool to see how the Secret Service works. Only because they do a lot of work. I mean, and what I remember is I became a police officer here in Cincinnati. And, you know, I got to see when Obama came through. I believe it was Barack Obama. Yeah, Barack Obama. He was coming through Cincinnati. And this was where I had to work on the other side of the fence this time. And so I had to do a protection detail. And I remember we have a local airport in Cincinnati called Lunkin Airport. And this airport is where a lot of presidents fly into, campaigns fly into this airport. And a week before they even showed up, we went through the process of traveling with the Secret Service to check all the manholes around the airport. We went through, checked every one of them. We checked the buildings. We checked any businesses around the airport. And we would tape off the manholes after we checked them. And they had a tape that they would use that they would put across the manhole. And it would say, the tape on it, it said checked by the Secret Service. It was a red tape. And they would do this so that way they could check the manholes. And then they would recheck them again 24 hours before the president showed up at the airport. Now, I remember that they wanted to make sure that, you know, the plane came in on a certain runway, that when the plane would arrive, that the plane had to be adjusted or set a certain way on the runway in case of an emergency or they had to take off. I remember the Secret Service members, there was, you know, thousands upon thousands of Secret Service members, and they were all over. I mean, you wouldn't even know who a Secret Service member is. You know, we're so used to seeing them dressed in suits and with the earpieces. And the ones I remember were the ones who had just looked like plain clothes. They did have earpieces in, but the earpieces were very unnoticeable. And truly, you would not know that person was a Secret Service member. I mean, unless you really knew what you were looking for. But so here they are. They're you know, bringing the president in, you know, making sure that the line, that when people would come to the airport to visit the president, the president of the United States, they would have to make sure that they were back so many feet from the president. The limo or bulletproof vehicle that came up to pick him up was maneuvered a certain way to make sure that they could get him in as quick as possible. And then, of course, exit the airport swiftly and promptly, so that way there was no issues, you know, that somebody could try to attack President Barack Obama. Now, you know, I thought it was pretty cool seeing this because, you know, I was a police officer, like I said, and I was one of the ones that was at the airport and had to, you know, I had to do the detail where we had to escort the president, and we were told what to do by the Secret Service. And I remember that the Secret Service told us before we started, they said that you are now on detail as part of the Secret Service. And literally, we were sworn in to do what the Secret Service wanted us to do. And so we had to abide by what their laws were as far as what their rules were, federal rules, and protecting, you know, the president at all measures. It didn't matter what your political affiliation was, you were there to protect the president of the United States and to make sure nothing happened. And for that to happen in your city, if something were to happen to the president, would be an embarrassment to you, to your city, and to everybody around you. So it was so important that we took it very serious as to make sure that they were protected. And but the length that the Secret Service go through is amazing. And I'm telling anyone out there, they really do a lot of work beforehand just to protect the President of the United States. Now, I have a cousin. She lives in Virginia, and she is a former Secret Service member. And we talked about, you know, we sat down one day, and she's older, way older than I am. She's like now in her 70s. I'm in my 40s. And she's like my second cousin. And so we sat down one day, we were talking about, you know, what she did and who she guarded. And she protected everybody from John F. Kennedy up. And it was really cool to sit down with her and just hear some of the details that she had to do. And it, again, it's truly amazing what they go through, the length of trying to protect the president and the work that they do. To me, it's just fascinating work that they do to protect, like I said, the President of the United States. But there's a lot involved in it. And this is kind of like what I can share with people, that, you know, it's not exactly like Hollywood movies is what you see. It's a lot more in-depth detail. Air Force One, which is very well protected, it can sustain pretty much anything. And it can actually last for hours upon hours and days in the sky if there was to be some kind of situation. So all this takes place to understand what the Secret Service do to protect the President of the United States. So let's get more in depth on protecting the President. Here's our last audio clip on the details of what the Secret Service members do.
They are one of the greatest security forces in the world.
Security room copy. All posts. Be advised. Rawhide. Move to the cars.
I think Secret Service is probably the finest law enforcement agency that anybody can work for.
They have agreed to lay down their life in the protection of their president and whoever they are assigned to.
If I need to keep the president alive by giving up my life, then so be it.
We need a car. We need a transport. We need a transport.
I don't know of a single other group that makes a stronger commitment when they sign on the dotted line.
It's part of the job. That's my mission. The Secret Service began in 1865 as an investigative agency. We were created under the Department of Treasury. During the Civil War, most of the money that was in circulation was counterfeit. So President Lincoln at the time created the Secret Service. The piece of irony there is, although we were created for the investigative mission and nothing to do with protecting the president, the day after he signed the legislation to create the agency, of course, he goes to Ford's Theater and gets assassinated by Booth. We didn't start protecting presidents until later on, early in the 1900s, after the second assassination of a president. After the assassination of Robert Kennedy, we began protecting major candidates for the office of the president. We also protect all of the candidates during the campaign once they rise to a certain level.
The Secret Service has a few details. The one that we are the most familiar with is obviously the protective detail.
Their first duty is to protect the continuity of government, to protect the president, to protect the line of succession so that the country keeps running.
In addition, we protect former first ladies as long as they remain together and don't remarry. The example there is Jackie Kennedy marrying Onassis. Once she married Onassis, we no longer protected her. We still protect Lady Bird Johnson. So there's an example of someone that we protected since 1962. In protecting the president, we will protect them for the rest of their life. However, during the Clinton administration, the law was changed. We will only protect President Bush for 10 years after he leaves the presidency. We have a significant investigative mission to include threats against the president.
I got your message. I know you want me to kill you.
Most of your career is spent doing the investigations. Only a small portion of your career is spent doing the protections.
The Secret Service is directly associated with the Treasury Department.
We investigate all matters related to counterfeit currency, identity theft, high-tech electronic crimes. Every asset that you can imagine is available to the Office of the President through the Secret Service.
141 years, there's never been a traitor in the Secret Service.
And the President of the United States is, in fact, in a great deal of danger from within his own government. That would make it very hard for the Secret Service to identify and locate a problem.
Polygraph will be ordered immediately for anybody with access to the president.
We've never had anybody identified as a mole within the Secret Service, and we never will. Our recruitment process is such that it's the best of the best, but it is a leap. You have to give the audience something that's exciting.
Unite!
And it's a great Hollywood story. Hopefully that's where it stays.
You're late.
A minute passed.
Yeah, and that makes you late.
It's probably one of the most difficult law enforcement agencies in the world to become a part of.
The recruitment package today says older than age 23, younger than age 37. Typically, we're not taking the 23-year-old. We're looking for the more mature, established law enforcement or former military professional. Not absolutely essential, but if we can find that person, that's the likely recruit.
People people who enter the Secret Service are vicious, athletic people.
We have physical fitness requirements that mandate that you stay physically fit.
It also helps if you have a good reputation in the service. Most of the Secret Service agents that we hire are former law enforcement.
They don't just want the square-jawed white man anymore.
We will take applicants that have significant language skills.
Did you translate this?
No. Whoever did's not a native speaker.
How do you know that?
Slang. It means he bribed him. He didn't bite him.
Like everybody in law enforcement, we're always recruiting minority applicants and female applicants.
Hispanic woman, four languages, computer skills, second in your class at the academy. Well, aren't you the recruiting poster?
The pressure is very intense.
You got your gun and your radio. What the hell are you looking at her for? She's been here 2 days.
We look at all of our young agents coming through the door for specific skills.
We have a very large fraud investigative responsibility, and the people with computer knowledge really assist us in those investigations.
We need someone who can absolutely capture everything in a room as he walks in.
Tweet Jack halfway up the church steps.
What's the matter, Pete? You see somebody on the watch list?
Someone who can capture character.
He just doesn't look right.
Hi, sir. Can we see your hands, please? What are your hands? Just take your hands out of the jack.
I believe that it's a person who's confident in their abilities, but not cocky.
The Secret Service is such a strict organization. It really depends on the entire unit working by a certain set of rules.
We need someone who isn't fazed by anything intimidating. Someone who has enough fear to be aware of things, but isn't challenged by that fear. Those are the type of people that we're looking for.
You had some reason to think it wasn't a robber?
Well, Agent Merriweather spent the last 25 years honing his ability to sense danger, to notice anything outside of the ordinary. So for some average street criminal to get the drop on him, yeah, it raises some questions. They're an incredibly highly trained group. Very, very smart.
We field exercise against every type of attack you can imagine. You're constantly thinking, where could a potential attack come from?
You're constantly being retrained in new techniques.
The ongoing training for firearms is perhaps the most rigorous of any agency in civilian law enforcement. We shoot more than anybody else.
One facet that I found incredibly interesting is that the Secret Service draw a weapon differently than any other law enforcement agency they're trained to.
Safety's still on. We assumed he just didn't have time to flick it off.
Well, if he was a police officer, it would make sense because your academy trained you to draw your weapon and flip the safety in two separate actions to avoid accidental shooting. Our academy trains us to draw and flip in a single motion. If he managed to draw his weapon, his safety should have been on.
By the time a Secret Service agent actually draws their weapon, they fully intend to use it. So it was little fine details like that that we got to work on and work with some of the ex-Secret Service agents that we've had as part of our training. The people that I have met in the course of preparing for this film are some of the most interesting people that I've met. There is a very cowboy quality to them, even though the parameters with which they work are very narrow.
Obviously, one is limited to finding out all of the secret uses of intelligence and ways they have of protecting the president, vice president, first lady. In the Sentinel, we had a couple of good technical advisors, ex-agents.
So if you look through that, that's your dominant eye, okay? And what you're looking for is that sight to be paralleled.
The job with the Secret Service always interested me. I spent 20 years with the Secret Service. Prior to that, I had worked for the FBI for 5 years.
I was in the Secret Service 21 years. Helping to teach the actors what it feels like to shoot the weapons.
You see on film that the gun is doing this, it's not going to look good. So you want to lock it in with your face and that little cleft in your shoulder, like with a Thompson submachine gun, if you don't lean in. Once you start firing automatic, you'll be up here.
Also teaching them how the Secret Service normally handles the weapons.
Goes in the magazine well, you hear a click. Seat the magazine. As I said, this thing, once the magazine is in, slap that forward, chambers around, you're set to go.
My job was to make sure that these guys sounded like agents, not like Hollywood actors.
Classic is moving to Bravo cars.
Copy that.
The radio speak.
Pontiac and Raven are in the yard and ready to go.
We authenticated everything we could. We just didn't go out and get Cadillacs. We got Cadillacs that are absolutely the same as the Cadillacs the president uses. All of the props from the badges, the earpieces, the microphones we speak into in our sleeves. Make sure all the sets look like Secret Service offices, even the notebooks on the tables. All of the documents that you open up and have Secret Service seals. all of the weapons they used.
Jerry's great. He was the lead on our Secret Service training. He helps us by keeping us from looking stupid. Don't hold the gun like this. Don't bounce with the gun when you're running.
We went through some primary gun training, shooting techniques.
I taught them how to shoot with real guns, not Hollywood guns.
We were firing live ammunition, so when you have all those police and you hold the gun up there and you're looking at it, say, oh, okay, it's got a real bullet there.
You know, I wanted them to feel what the Secret Service feels.
No way! Don't make me do this.
So I only had a couple of days. I couldn't put them through an entire academy.
They've done great. I've been very impressed. They were very professional. Many of them haven't shot weapons before. They shot very well.
There was some friendly competition going on between Eva, myself, and Kiefer. We had a Secret Service agent, and they all kind of bet that, you know, Kiefer was going to be the best shot.
When we had our firearms training, we had to do an obstacle course, and you shoot these steel things that fall down, and you shoot a bad guy holding hostage. You know, you shoot the targets, and then you push this button, and they come all the way up, and you get to tear yours off. So I look at Kiefer's, and I go, oh, you shoot low. And then I look at Michael's, and I'm like, where are your bullets?
And of course, Eva outshot everybody.
I've always gone target shooting with my dad, so being a firing range is no big deal to me.
She shoots better than 90% of the agents or police officers they ever dealt with.
Kiefer was like, ah. Well, you know, technically women are always better shooters. It's a proven fact, women are more accurate because they have less adrenaline pumping through their body, so they're slower and more smooth with the trigger. Kiefer and Michael are mad because a girl's better than them. It's a proven fact. I'm sorry. I'm just better. With a movie like this that doesn't show the Secret Service in the best light, it's nice to get someone's technical advice on a movie like this that you may not support.
Listen, everything we do isn't all that exciting sometimes, but at least in this movie, it's authentic as it can possibly get without being the real thing.
I think they got it. They look good.
Hopefully, my training and the things that I have available to me in terms of survivability will keep me alive. But if I have to give my life for the President of the United States, I was prepared to do that for 20 years. I'm still prepared to do it today.
There's a very special kind of person that takes on that responsibility.
The consequences are so much more severe in this job than if you were a secretary and misfiled something.
The commitment they have to make is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It's a highly prestigious security agent, very well respected by all agencies.
Well, I want to really thank the gentlemen that we have worked with and thank them for the time, for not laughing when we make our mistakes, or at least not laughing too hard. They've been fantastic.
It's a fascinating career. You will see the world, get all the training you can possibly get. Be proud of your country.
The people that make up the Secret Service are true patriots.
Only the best of the best need a plaque. They're the only ones that are going
to
make it.
It's been an honor to be able to play one of them.
President. We also protect all of the candidates during the campaign once they rise to a certain level.
The Secret Service has a few details. The one that we are the most familiar with is obviously the protective detail.
Their first duty is to protect the continuity of government, to protect the president, to protect the line of succession so that the country keeps running.
In addition, we protect former first ladies as long as they remain together and don't remarry. The example there is Jackie Kennedy marrying Onassis. Once she married Onassis, we no longer protected her. We still protect Lady Bird Johnson. So there's an example of someone that we protected since 1962. In protecting the president, we will protect them for the rest of their life. However, during the Clinton administration, the law was changed. We will only protect President Bush for 10 years after he leaves the presidency. We have a significant investigative mission to include threats against the president.
I got your message. I know you want me to kill you.
Most of your career is spent doing the investigations. Only a small portion of your career is spent doing the protections.
The Secret Service is directly associated with the Treasury Department.
We investigate all matters related to counterfeit currency, identity theft, high-tech electronic crimes. Every asset that you can imagine is available to the Office of the President through the Secret Service.
141 years, there's never been a traitor in the Secret Service.
And the President of the United States is, in fact, in a great deal of danger from within his own government. That would make it very hard for the Secret Service to identify and locate a problem.
Polygraph will be ordered immediately for anybody with access to the President.
We've never had anybody identified as a mole within the Secret Service, and we never will. Our recruitment process is such that it's the best of the best, but it is a leap. You have to give the audience something that's exciting.
Unite!
And it's a great Hollywood story. Hopefully that's where it stays.
You're late.
A minute passed.
Yeah, and that makes you late.
It's probably one of the most difficult law enforcement agencies in the world to become a part of.
The recruitment package today says older than age 23, younger than age 37. Typically, we're not taking the 23-year-old. We're looking for the more mature, established law enforcement or former military professional. Not absolutely essential, but if we can find that person, that's the likely recruit.
People who enter the Secret Service are ambitious, athletic people.
We have physical fitness requirements that mandate that you stay physically fit.
It also helps if you have a good reputation in the service. Most of the Secret Service agents that we hire are former law enforcement.
They don't just want the square-jawed white men anymore.
We will take applicants that have significant language skills.
Did you translate this?
No. Whoever did, not a native speaker.
How do you know that?
President, Vice President, First Lady. In the Sentinel, we had a couple of good technical advisors, ex-agents.
So if you look through that, that's your dominant eye. Okay? And what you're looking for is that sight to be paralleled.
The job with the Secret Service always interested me. I spent 20 years with the Secret Service. Prior to that, I had worked for the FBI for 5 years.
I was in the Secret Service 21 years. I'm helping to teach the actors what it feels like to shoot the weapons.
You see on film that the gun is doing this, it's not going to look good. So you want to lock it in with your face and that little cleft in your shoulder, like with a Thompson submachine gun, if you don't lean in. Once you start firing automatic, you'll be up here.
Also teaching them how the Secret Service normally handles the weapons.
Goes in the magazine well, you hear a click. Seat the magazine. As I said, this thing, once the magazine is in, slap that forward, chambers around, you're set to go.
My job was to make sure that these guys sounded like agents, not like Hollywood actors.
Class 50 is moving to Bravo cars.
Copy that.
The radio speak.
Pontiac and Raven are in the yard and ready to go.
We authenticated everything we could. We just didn't go out and get Cadillacs. We got Cadillacs that are absolutely the same as the Cadillacs the president uses. All of the props from the badges, the earpieces, the microphones we speak into in our sleeves. Make sure all the sets look like Secret Service offices, even the notebooks on the tables. All of the documents that you open up and have Secret Service seals. All of the weapons they use.
Jerry's great. He was the lead on our Secret Service training. He helped us by keeping us from looking stupid. Don't hold the gun like this. Don't bounce with the gun when you're running.
We went through some primary gun training, shooting techniques.
I taught them how to shoot with real guns, not Hollywood guns.
We were firing live ammunition. So when you have all those police and you hold the gun up there and you're looking at it, say, oh, okay, it's got a real bullet there.
You know, I wanted them to feel what the Secret Service feels.
No way! Don't make me do this.
I only had a couple of days. I couldn't put them through an entire academy.
They've done great. I've been very impressed. They were very professional. Many of them haven't shot weapons before. They shot very well.
There was some friendly competition going on between Eva, myself, and Kiefer. We had a Secret Service agent, and they all kind of bet that, you know, Kiefer was going to be the best shot.
When we had our firearms training, we had to do an obstacle course, and you shoot these steel things that fall down, and you shoot a bad guy holding hostage. You know, you shoot the targets, and then you push this button, and they come all the way up, and you get to tear yours off. So I look at Kiefer's, and I go, oh, you shoot low. And then I look at Michael's, and I'm like,
Where are your bullets?
And of course, Eva outshot everybody.
I've always gone target shooting with my dad.
Best security forces in the world.
Security room copy. All posts, all posts. Be advised. Rawhide. Through the cars.
I think Secret Service is probably the finest law enforcement agency that anybody can work for.
They have agreed to lay down their life in the protection of their president and whoever they are assigned to.
If I need to keep the president alive by giving up my life, then so be it.
I don't know of a single other group that makes a stronger commitment when they sign on the dotted line.
It's part of the job. That's my mission. The Secret Service began in 1865 as an investigative agency. We were created under the Department of Treasury. During the Civil War, most of the money that was in circulation was counterfeit. So President Lincoln at the time created the Secret Service. The piece of irony there is although we were created for the investigative mission and nothing to do with protecting the president, the day after he signed the legislation to create the agency, of course, he goes to Ford's Theater and gets assassinated by Booth. We didn't start protecting presidents until later on, early in the 1900s, after the second assassination of a president. After the assassination of Robert Kennedy, we began protecting major candidates for the office of the president. We also protect all of the candidates during the campaign once they rise to a certain level.
The Secret Service has a few details. The one that we are the most familiar with is obviously the protective detail.
Their first duty is to protect the continuity of government, to protect the president, to protect the line of succession so that the country keeps running.
In addition, we protect former first ladies as long as they remain together and don't remarry. The example there is Jackie Kennedy marrying Onassis. Once she married Onassis, we no longer protected her. We still protect Lady Bird Johnson. So there's an example of someone that we protected since 1962. In protecting the president, we will protect them for the rest of their life. However, during the Clinton administration, the law was changed. We will only protect President Bush for 10 years after he leaves the presidency. We have a significant investigative mission to include threats against the president.
I got your message. I know you want me to kill you.
Most of your career is spent doing the investigations. Only a small portion of your career is spent doing the protections.
The Secret Service is directly associated with the Treasury Department.
We investigate all matters related to counterfeit currency, identity theft, high-tech electronic crimes. Every asset that you can imagine is available to the Office of the President through the Secret Service.
141 years. There's never been a traitor in the Secret Service.
And the President of the United States